Thank you very much for the introduction. Can you hear me in the back? Yes? No? Okay, thank you for the introduction and for the invitation. So I'd like to tell you today about visual object recognition, and of course we use visual recognition for almost everyday tasks such as navigation, reading, socialization, and so on. So I'd like to argue that any theory of visual recognition needs to explain at least four key elements. The first one is selectivity, the fact that we can discriminate among different objects or different pictures that are very similar at the pixel level. And our visual system is very picky, very selective in terms of what it can discriminate. The second key aspect is tolerance to object transformations. That is, any object can cast an infinite number of projections onto the retina, and we can still discriminate those and recognize those in spite of these transformations, which are illustrated here in this schematic fashion by transforming the Van Gogh flowers in terms of color, rotation, and so on. Another aspect that people have emphasized is speed, and people illustrate that in a number of ways, for example, by flashing lots of pictures without telling you what the pictures are and showing that you can still discriminate those pictures, even though each one of those was present for about 100 milliseconds or so in your retina. And that places a strong constraint in terms of the number of computations that can happen in the brain for visual recognition. And the other point that I'd like to make is that our capacity is quite large. So it's illustrated here in the context of faces. I'm going to give lots of examples with faces, but it also happens in the context of other types of objects. We can recognize lots and lots of different types of objects. So it's not a specific system for a specific type of stimuli that we need to account for, but a generic shape recognition system. So what I'd like to do today is basically give an overview of some of the work at the computational level as well as at the physiological level that has that we've done together with many other people to document these very fast recognition processes and how this can be simply described by bottom-up architectures. And then I'd like to give two examples of tasks that I think are beginning to get into what happens beyond the very first steps in recognition, tasks that may probably involve top-down connections and that will require extending some of our basic bottom-up architectures for recognition. So to start, I'd like to show this diagram that's probably familiar to many of you by Feldman and Van Essen, describing what we know about the coarse connectivity among many visual areas in the primate brain. So at the bottom of this diagram, there will be the retina projecting to the LGN, to primary visual cortex. And from there, a cascade of processes along the ventral visual stream that I'm going to be focusing on today, from V1 to V2, V4, and inferior temporal cortex. Again, most of this is based on what we know about the anatomy of the connectivity of different brain areas in the macaque visual cortex. And then on the right, I'm showing an architecture that many people in Tommy Poggio's lab have been working on based on a model that tries to mimic some of the processing along the ventral visual stream to perform object recognition. And this is work that has been published, so I'm going to go through this only very quickly. There are a couple of things that I'd like to point out in terms of this particular instantiation of this model. There are many similar bottom-up architectures that people have proposed. There are some names in here. So the first one is that this is a purely bottom-up architecture. There are no feedback connections. There are no lateral connections. And there are two main operations. One is a tuning operation. The other one is an invariance operation. And if I can describe this very succinctly in this slide, basically what we do is we take an image, we take away the color, we work with grayscale images, we convolve this image with Gabor filters. This aims to mimic some of the basic tuning properties of neurons in primary visual cortex. We use four different orientations. After convolving the image with these Gabor patches, we have a soft maximum operation. This provides a certain degree of tolerance to the specific position of that feature in the visual in the visual field. And then we essentially repeat the process. We have another tuning operation here by using radial basis functions. And the centers of these are random patches from natural images. And then we have another softmax operation. So we can take any image, run this through this cascade of processes, and then we can compare that against human performance. We can compare that against the responses of neurons recorded from different parts of visual cortex. So just to give one example of that, Here's a set of 77 different pictures that we used in an experiment with Jim DiCarlo at MIT, recording the activity of neurons in inferior temporal cortex. And here, this is the depiction of a subset of the neurons at the top level of this model. So on this axis here, there are all the different objects that were presented. And here, there are about 256 different neurons. The color here indicates the intensity of the activity of each of these units at the top level of this model. And I'd like to emphasize that there are zero free parameters here. So we're not really trying to fine-tune parameters in the model for this specific set of objects. So if you compare then how well we can decode the presence or absence of each of these pictures, and I'm going to go through this quickly, but people have done have shown this in several of the previous presentations as well. Basically, we use a classifier here. In this particular case, it's a linear classifier. We're looking at the activity of a small pseudopopulation of single neurons recorded from macaque monkey inferior temporal cortex. And we're asking how well can we discriminate the presence or absence of each of these 77 pictures, which are here divided into 8 different categories. So this classification performance here corresponds to how well a linear classifier can do in terms of discriminating one of these 8 possible categories from this pseudopopulation of 64 neurons. So chance here would be 1 divided by 8. So if we focus on the white bars, this is what a small set of IT neurons can do. So this set of neurons can do very well above chance. And just to provide you a little bit more of detail in terms of what we're doing here, the pictures were presented in this particular case at different scales or at different positions with respect to fixation. And we used different data sets for training and testing the classifier. So in this case, for example, we train with the classifier with the data recorded at this particular position and scale, and we test the performance of the classifier with the response of the neurons to these pictures at these different positions. So what we observe is that there is a small population of IT neurons can do can decode. We can decode the presence or absence of these different categories from this small population of neurons. And so can we also from this small set of units from the top level in the model. And again, the fact that these numbers are pretty similar is somewhat coincidental in the sense that we're not really trying to fit specifically. We're not really tuning any parameters. There are zero free parameters in this model. There are, of course, all the parameters involved in the classifier, but those are the same in the physiological data and in the computational model. So this model achieves a significant amount of selectivity to discriminate these objects, as well as tolerance, in this case, to these two simple affine transformations, scale and position. So now I'd like to move on to describe what happens in the human brain when we show pictures. What sort of selectivity and tolerance to transformations can we get along the ventral visual stream in the human brain? And the way we do that is by doing invasive recordings by collaborating with neurosurgeons. And here's a list of neurosurgeons that we've collaborated with over the years to be able to monitor the activity of either neurons or field potentials in different parts of the human brain. These are patients who have intractable epilepsy, and they need to be implanted with electrodes in order to localize the seizure focus for potential surgical resections. So these patients stay in the hospital for about 1 week. And this gives us an opportunity, a rather rare opportunity, to listen to the activity of either neurons or field potentials in different parts of the human cortex. And this is a sample MR image of one of these patients showing the position of one of these electrodes. And I should emphasize for the people who are used to working with either mice or monkeys or other species that we have lots and lots of limitations in terms of what we can do with these type of recordings. For example, we cannot really choose where to put the electrodes. The location of the electrodes is purely dictated by clinical considerations. Depending on the particular type of patient, we use different types of electrodes. And we've done a lot of work previously with this type of depth electrodes and microwires that target deep structures such as the hippocampus and surrounding structures. But today I'd like to focus on recordings that we've done with these type of electrodes. So there are two types of electrodes shown in here. One is what people usually refer to as ECOG electrodes. These are low impedance, 2 millimeter diameter electrodes. These are still invasive. This is not scalp EEG. This is invasive subdural electrodes, but these have low impedance. And in addition to that, we also use microwires that you can sort of see here. These are 40 micron platinum iridium high impedance microwires, but these microwires do not really penetrate cortex. So while from these penetrating electrodes we could get unit activity, from these electrodes what I'm going to show you is field potential data as opposed to single unit data. So it's a huge trade-off in terms of the biophysics. People discussed yesterday how difficult it is to interpret the activity of field potentials, and we don't have a clear biophysical interpretation of what's happening at the level of field potentials. But the big advantage of using this type of electrodes for us is that we can tap into activity along the ventral visual stream in the human brain, as opposed to activity in the hippocampus and non-visual areas that we studied before. So we use procedures that are common to a lot of people here. We track eye movements. In some cases, we can try to map receptive fields by flashing stimuli in different parts of the in different parts of the monitor. Here's an example. This is the vertical distance from fixation, the horizontal distance from fixation. These are the field potentials that we evoked. This is a particularly large receptive field from one of the electrodes located here. So here's one example experiment where we flash different pictures, different shapes, including faces, but also fruits, cars, and different types of objects. And what I'm showing here is the average activity of this electrode to five different categories of stimuli. Red in this particular case corresponds to faces. And the way I'm showing this is showing the intracranial field potential that we record from this electrode as a function of time. These were pictures that were presented for 150 milliseconds while the subject was performing a simple one-back recognition task. And here I'm showing you individual trials. Here's every single trial of the data. So each of these corresponds to a single trial. The pictures here are presented, these are multiple repetitions of picture one, these are multiple repetitions of picture two, and so on. And you can see an enhancement in the response. The color code here corresponds to voltage. This is the scale here. So you can see that essentially in every single trial almost, we can observe very strong responses to this type of picture. So this is the closest that we can that we could think of in terms of how to represent the data in the raw possible format, as close as possible to the raster plots that we're used to seeing in the context of spikes. So just one thing I forgot to say is that this is basically raw data. We're filtering the data from 1 to 300 hertz in this case, and there's a notch filter at 60 hertz. Other than that, there is absolutely no processing whatsoever before showing this plot. Here's another example. Here's the intracranial field potential as a function of time. The previous example was data recorded from a microwire with high impedance. This is data recorded from an ECOG electrode, a 2 millimeter electrode with low impedance, again showing that there's a strong selectivity to different types of shapes. One of the key aspects of visual recognition is not just to show selectivity, but also to be able to describe tolerance to object transformations. So here I'm showing responses to different versions of the same picture. In this particular case, there are three possible scales or different rotations of the same picture. And what you can see is that the selectivity of this electrode, this is the location of the electrode, the selectivity of this electrode is significantly maintained across all of these different transformations. And what I forgot to point in the previous slides, but I'd like to point here, is that these responses are quite fast. These happen well before 200 milliseconds of stimulus onset. So this is a summary of a lot of data. We've shown different types of pictures to a lot of patients. And this is a summary of our ability to classify in individual trials what pictures were presented from a lot of different regions. And this is summarized in these funny color maps that I never can understand. But just to describe basically the sort of regions where we can find visually selective responses along the human ventral visual stream. And if you know, if you've seen the sort of macaque primate brain, this is quite consistent with a lot of recordings over the years along the ventral stream. We see a lot of selectivity also along the human ventral visual stream. Quickly, there's lots of ways in which one can try to determine the latency of these responses. And I'm not going to go into the details. In this particular case, we're looking for the first time point when we can discriminate one shape from the other shapes. And this is the distribution of the object of the latencies for each of these electrodes. So we see that the latencies are typically quite short. Again, this is consistent with the single neuron recordings that have been done in macaque monkeys in ventral stream areas such as V4 and particularly inferior temporal cortex. So now I'd like to move beyond these very simple flashing pictures and very rapid recognition tasks to talk about novel data that we haven't published yet with two different tasks that we think cannot really be simply explained by purely bottom-up architectures, and which will involve potentially top-down connections. And the indirect evidence that I would like to propose for that is that these tasks take longer to complete, both at the behavioral level as well as at the physiological level. So the first one involves object completion. And the way we looked at object completion is by using a paradigm called bubbles. Basically, we take pictures and we show those pictures through bubbles. Depending on the number of bubbles, it becomes easier or harder to recognize those images. In this particular case, this is a toy school bus. And you can see that if there are many bubbles, you can recognize the object quite well. And if there are very few bubbles, it's very hard to recognize the object. So this is sort of like looking at the world like this, basically. So you have a small aperture through which you look at the world. The more of those apertures that you have, the easier it is to recognize the object. So the task that we did is, again, very simple. We start with fixation. Then we sometimes present full images. And then we ask people to, in this case, to categorize those images to ensure that they recognize them. In this particular case, with a five alternative forced choice categorization task. And in some other trials, we present these occluded images by showing them through these bubbles. And again, people have to categorize them. Pictures are presented very fast for about 150 milliseconds. So this is, I'll start with the behavioral data. These are 12 subjects that went through this paradigm. And we titrated the number of bubbles in each subject to achieve approximately 80% performance. So we wanted the task to be not completely trivial, so that they wouldn't be at ceiling, and at the same time, not impossible. So we manipulated initially the number of bubbles to basically get at this performance level. So first, I'd like to show you behavioral evidence from subjects that did not go through the physiological data, where we did a slightly different version of the task, just to argue what you may intuitively already know, which is that if you have to recognize objects that are occluded, you may need more processing time. That is, it takes longer to recognize objects that are occluded. And the way I'm showing you that is by using a masking paradigm, where we showed pictures that are masked, and those pictures could be either full pictures or occluded pictures. So these are this is the performance for full pictures as a function of the SOA. This is the stimulus onset asynchrony. This is the time between the stimulus onset and the disappearance of the mask. In the top case, there is no mask. The picture disappears, but there is no mask. And subjects are essentially at ceiling. This is a very simple task. In the case of occluded images, here, subjects' performance is a little bit worse, but there's basically no effect of stimulus onset asynchrony. In stark contrast with that, when we have occluded images, this should have been an occluded image. This is a full image here, but it should have been an occluded image. So in the, these are the full images, these are the occluded images. So in the case of full images, again, there is no dependence of on the stimulus onset asynchrony with masking. But in the case of occluded images, we see a very strong dependence on stimulus onset asynchrony. And we interpret this to imply that there's a need for more processing time at the behavioral level to be able to recognize objects that are occluded after a fast mask. And people have argued, and we can debate about the extent to which that's correct, that this type of very fast masks are inhibiting top-down processing as opposed to bottom-up processing. So let me now go back to the physiology and show you what happens in the human brain when you occlude images at the physiological level. So this is the same electrode I showed you before. Again, these are single trials in response to full images. And now, if we occlude those images, here's what happens with the responses. So first of all, there's a little bit of attenuation in the magnitude of the response. So typically we have stronger blue and stronger red colors in here than here. But what's also particularly noticeable in here is that there is a significant difference in the latency of the responses. Look at the alignment of the responses here on the left compared to the alignment here on the right, as well as a considerable increase in the latency of the responses in each individual trial. Part of this can be accounted for the simple variability in the images. That is, the images from one trial to another are different because of differential random positions of the bubbles. And that can account partly for the variability, but not for the latency. So the latency is still pretty clear here, even by eyeballing the data at the, with individual trials. So we also run a separate condition, which is the fixed bubble condition. So here we fix the position of the bubbles so that the trial-to-trial variability could not be accounted in this case simply by differences in the visual stimulus. So here we see that there is less variability, less trial-to-trial variability here compared to this condition. But there's still more variability, I would argue, than in the full condition, as well as longer latencies. This is the 200 millisecond time point. You see that there's a clear decrease in voltage here before 200 milliseconds that we don't see here. So upon occluding the images, we see a pretty clear delay in the responses that we can see here in this in single trials. So now showing you averages over all the trials. Here's another electrode. Again, this is the intracranial field potential as a function of time. This is the increase in voltage, the change in voltage that I already showed for the full images. And this is what happens for the unoccluded images. Again, you see that the peak here is close to 200 milliseconds. The peak here is significantly delayed. Again, this is the same electrode just showing each individual exemplar image. Here's another example. And moving quickly now, we were particularly interested in the latency of the responses. And what I'm showing here is the latency of the responses for all the electrodes that showed visual selectivity to different shapes. And here's the latency to occluded images as a function of the latency to full images. So we can debate about exactly how latencies are computed. There are lots of different ways in which one can compute latencies. But what we see here is that the latencies for the occluded images were significantly longer than the latencies for the full images. So basically, in all but one example, the latencies were longer. So I'll skip many of the details. We try to compute latencies in all sorts of ways. And what I'm showing here is the difference in latency for occluded versus full images. And we always observe a latency difference of at least 100 milliseconds or so, no matter what the exact methodology. So the absolute value of the latency may depend on exactly how you define it, but the difference between the two was quite clear. So we, as a very indirect approximation, we use these latencies to imply more computation time. So what can we do with more computation time? So we talked about the bottom-up architecture that can describe some of the very basic recognition processes for full images. So now I'll give you 100 milliseconds or so, just in a very coarse fashion. If we think that each computation takes about 10 to 15 milliseconds, that's a very, very rough approximation to each processing stage along the ventral visual stream. Now we have a few additional computations that you can use. How can you use those to describe object completion? So first, let me show you what the bottom-up model does for occluded images. Here's the percentage of the image that's unoccluded. So 100% means that we are showing full images. 0% would mean a blank screen. And this is the classification performance in single trials from the computational model now as a function of the percentage of occlusion. As you can see, as you might expect, the smaller amount of image that you're showing, the worse the model performs in object recognition. This point here is not actually zero. It's actually 1% of the image that's being shown. And I would have liked that to be exactly at chance levels. And it's not, partly because these classifiers are extremely powerful and they can still discriminate the objects even if you show just a handful of pixels. So here, basically, you have just a handful of pixels of the image and you can still discriminate them. It's not a very impressive performance above chance, but it's still above chance. So this is what the bottom-up architecture does. So now we'd like to improve upon this architecture by allowing ourselves a few extra computations based on the behavior as well as the physiology. And I'm going to go through this quickly. The way we do that is by adding just one layer on top of the model, which is basically an attractor network. Going back to the work of John Hopfield and many others, people have shown that attractor networks are very good at pattern completion tasks. So basically what I'm illustrating here is the responses of three units in the model to four different prototype objects. And now we have the response of these three units in a 3D plot to a particular object that doesn't quite look like any of the prototypes. So now we have an occluded image, and we have to guess which one this particular occluded object corresponds to in terms of these prototypes. So essentially, we have an attractor network, and this is illustrated in this cartoon fashion here, that will basically draw the responses of this to this particular occluded image closer to one of these prototypes. So if we add this top-down signal, basically this attractor network at the top of the hierarchy, we see that we can improve performance. And this is not very impressive. Again, there are zero free parameters in here. We're not really trying to tweak the parameters of the model. This is just a proof of principle that by adding a few computations, we can improve the performance of the model in terms of recognizing occluded objects. Here's a more sophisticated version of that, where we, in the previous case, we only included top-down signals at the top level in the model. Here we include top-down signals for every possible pair of layers in the model. And what I'm showing you here is the performance of this model as a function of time. Time here is measured as cycles through which this computation goes through. And here we are showing this for different numbers of bubbles, that is, for different amounts of visual occlusion. So for example, if we focus on a given performance level, say 70%, we see that as we have more occlusion, that is, as we have a smaller number of bubbles, we need more time in this computational model to recognize the objects. So essentially, I'm making a lot of assumptions here, but the basic notion is that we are using physiology as well as behavior to estimate the time it takes to perform a certain computation, and we are translating that time into how many computational steps we can use in the computational model. So what's the time now?
You've got like 8 more minutes.
Okay. So I'd like to very quickly give you another example of a different type of task that we also think cannot be purely accounted in terms of bottom-up architecture and will likely involve top-down signals. And that's searching for targets in cluttered images. So I'd like to go back to work that we did a few years ago, where the main goal of this particular experiment was to look at what happens in the context of clutter, that is, what happens when you put two images within the receptive field as opposed to only one image. But the particular aspect of this task that I'd like to discuss today is that subjects were performing a target detection task. So the images were blocked, and subjects had to indicate the presence or absence of a particular target category, in this particular case, cars, for each of these images. So there would be an image, and the subject would have to say yes or no whether the target was present. And what we were really trying to look at is how robust were the physiological responses to clutter. And this is what we mostly entertain ourselves with, showing that if these are the responses to single objects, this is the type of selectivity that I've been showing you in many slides before. When we add clutter, we see only a very small amount of attenuation. And I'm going to skip all of this because all of this is described already. But what I'd like to draw your attention to is what we observed when we compared those trials that included the target versus those trials where the target was absent. So most of the visual responses that we have described happen basically here, somewhere after 100 milliseconds and well before 300 milliseconds of after stimulus onset. But when we looked at those trials that included the target or not, we saw very strong differences. In this particular case, this is an electrode that shows a differential response to the presence of target versus non-target. And typically, these differences occurred well after 300 milliseconds. So this is pretty late into the trial. This is the reaction time here. And I'm not going to go into the details, but we have lots of reason to think that this is really not related to the behavioral output in the response, but rather to the fact that subjects are performing a target detection task in this case. This is the same data from the same electrode, except that instead of averaging every single trial, now I'm showing you every single image that was presented to the subject. And the reason I do that is because I want to compare cases where we have the same two objects on the screen. So in each of these cases, we have the same two objects. The number of trials is ridiculously small in these cases. So for example, if we focus on this particular rectangle here, these are the responses for each one of those images with the same two objects comparing target versus non-target. And you can see, this gives you an idea, that this is the number of trials. So again, these are very, very few trials. But this gives you an idea that even by looking at very few trials, we still see in many, but certainly not all cases, these differences between the target and non-target responses. And then if we average all of those, we see this response that I was showing here. So very quickly, we tried to go back to this question about how do we detect targets. And again, thinking that this is happening after initial bottom-up processing based on the physiological responses that we are seeing. So I'm going to skip the details. These are models that are basically inspired and starting with the bottom-up architecture, but again, trying to add top-down signals. And here we have basically a bottom-up architecture that provides visual input. We have a target object, and we're using the information from that target object in a top-down manner to provide a strong feedback signal that will influence the responses along these different feature detector columns. And I'm going to skip the details of this model, but basically what we can do with this basic simple top-down computational infrastructure is that we can try to start locating where the objects are. And so very quickly, this is a psychophysical experiment. We don't have enough physiology for this yet. Here, the task involves locating this particular object. So you have this object, you have an array, and then you have to make a saccade to the target object, either in images that look like this or in natural background. So here we have to locate these objects. So this is what the model can do. This is what you would expect just by chance. This is what we would expect from a purely saliency model that is in a purely bottom-up fashion. How well can you detect these objects? And this is what our model can do. That is, in a single fixation, we can already do well above chance. And this is the cumulative performance. This is for images that contain isolated objects. This is for images that have natural backgrounds. And this is just to compare with the psychophysics. We did a version of this that where a subject had to make an eye movement to the particular target. And this is performance as a function of the number of fixations. Random, bottom-up saliency, the top-down model, and this is what subjects do. And in this case, the model was trying to fit particularly the performance of subjects. So here there are lots of parameters that were adjusted to be able to account for these performance. And what was particularly remarkable to us is that we were trying to optimize overall performance. And here's what we, in some of the trials, we had target absent trials, that is trials where the target was not present. And then this is the pattern of behavior from the human subjects and the pattern of behavior from the model. So each point here corresponds to the probability that the subject would choose a particular object and the model would choose another object in this matrix. So the diagonal is the probability that the subject choice is identical to the model choice. And these numbers are not particularly large, so these are probabilities. Chance here would correspond to 1 over 6. This was an array of 6 objects. But we can see that there's a clear diagonal, even though perhaps not very impressive. This is still very preliminary work. But this is saying that even in target absent trials, the model can explain at least part of the performance of subjects in this simple categorization task. So I'd like to summarize this by making two simple points. The first one is that there are certain visual recognition tasks that we can do extremely fast. When I say extremely fast, I'm talking about 150 milliseconds or so. And we have behavioral evidence from a lot of groups that have shown that in 150 milliseconds or so, we can recognize objects. I showed you physiological evidence from different parts of the human ventral visual cortex. And I show you a computational infrastructure developed by a lot of people in Tommy Pocho's lab that can describe some of these cascade of processes that in about 10 computations or so can already allow us to recognize basic isolated objects and single and shapes. And I try to break this model by proposing two different conditions under which this very fast bottom-up recognition system would perhaps fail. One includes the recognition of objects that are partially occluded and where we need to gather information from experience and potentially use that information via top-down connections to recognize objects. And the evidence that this is based, that object completion is using top-down connections is highly indirect. And it's based on the fact that at both at the behavioral level as well as at the physiological level, we need more computational time to be able to recognize the occluded objects. And the second task is recognizing or localizing targets in a cluttered image. And in that case, typically we may need multiple fixations. And in order to describe both the physiological data where we saw the target detection signals that are pretty late, as well as the behavioral data, we also propose that we may need to use top-down signals to be able to account for target detection in complex images. So I'd like to finish here by acknowledging lots of people that worked, Jed Singer and several others that worked on the psychophysics. I mentioned many of the neurosurgeons that we collaborate with to be able to record physiological data. A lot of the computational work was started when I was working with Tomas Ser and Tommy Poggio, and later on several people in the lab were using, adding these top-down signals. So I'll stop there.
Thank you very much for your interesting talk. We have time for a few questions. Who wants to start? Crystal.
Tell me, we know there's quite a bit of evidence. There's quite a bit of evidence now that if you look at high gamma, that actually action potential are big and contributed to high gamma. So if you looked at specifically at the local field at gamma, and does it change the reaction time?
We did all the analysis at different for different frequencies. We looked at high gamma specifically, and we also see the same delays. So basically, we see lots of cases where we see very strong responses in low frequencies that we don't see in high frequencies. We see a few cases where we see responses in high frequencies that we don't see in low frequencies. But they seem to be, there's a paper that said that these are antagonistic responses. At the very least, they seem to be independent responses. We seem to be seeing different responses in low frequencies as well as high frequencies. But the delay is present both also in high gamma as well.
Again. Yep.